again, Bob Chaundy here with another Considering Art podcast, in which I talk to an artist about their work and something of their life. My guest today is the young British painter James Mortimer. James has created a world in his paintings and drawings in which men and women exist in a primeval world where the laws of the jungle prevail. It's a world of fantastical landscapes graced with mountains and the odd erupting volcano, of tiny islands and monstrous-looking plants, and where birds, monkeys, crocodiles and other creatures share equal status with humans. There's humour there too. Naked or semi-naked people cast morals and social constraint aside and give themselves over to wanton violence or sexual impropriety. So you see a man bathing who's blissfully unaware that behind him a naked man is grappling with a woman he's probably trying to drown. In another work, a man is wrestling with another and trying to throw him down a well. Or headless human corpses are crawled over by monkeys, one of which has been caught by vultures. You get the picture. James once said, "I like people who lack self-awareness, who do shameful, inappropriate or inexplicable things with blasé nonchalance." He's exhibited extensively in the UK, and in 2018 his sculpture Crocodile Head was shown at the Royal Academy Summer Exhibition. I spoke to him from his home in Bath. James, welcome to the Considering Art podcast. Nice to see you again.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Now, I know that you come from an artistic background, so what did your parents or your family do in the way of art?
Yeah, everyone in my family's sort of arty. My mother was quite technical and was quite skilled at calligraphy and things like that. And my father did quite strange, quite rough, raw sort of art when he was younger and then became a landscape architect. And my grandmother was quite art. Well, yeah, she was quite artistic. She did embroidery. She made these amazing pictures of sort of Shakespearean scenes and scenes from life and things like that with really incredible colours. It was quite amazing what she could do. I think she took it up later in life. All of her sons had started painting, and she said, "Well, none of them are going to start doing embroidery, so I guess I'll do that." And my great-grandmother was this slightly eccentric woman called Lesbia, who did lots of... I've got some of these really horrible watercolours of like Victorian ladies, and she wrote these weird little plays for her local pantomime or something. So, yeah, there was a sort of vein of creativity.
Yeah, it sounds like a bit of an eccentric creativity that you've carried on.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think that's been sort of... embrace the sort of eccentricity and a sort of slightly off-colour humour that runs through my background.
Presumably you drew a lot as a child, did you?
Yeah, sort of immediately. I got a collection of my old drawings from early on, and it's exactly what I paint now. It's sort of crocodiles and monkeys and jungles and volcanoes and houses and things on fire and things like that. So it was quite sort of disheartening to look back at that and think, oh, well, there'd be no development whatsoever. It's exactly the same.
Well, the development might not have changed, but presumably the execution is a bit more sophisticated.
Yeah, hopefully. But no, it's quite nice to see those old pieces. I was quite happy with some of them. I guess when I was a child, it was the one thing I was sort of praised for. And when you suddenly get praised for something, you realise you can impress people with something. And so I think that's what led me down that path, realising I could impress someone with what I was doing. So I was always the arty child in the school. I grew up in Swindon, which was this sort of quite boring post-industrial town. So it wasn't a very arty place to grow up. But for some reason, that was always in me.
I have this sneaking suspicion that you were one of those kids who sits at the back of the class drawing rude pictures.
Yeah, pretty much. It wasn't that rude always, because I was quite swotty and sort of teacher's pet as well. So I'd ingratiate myself and get my pictures put in the corridor and stuff like that.
You went to Bath School of Art and Design, and I believe you... you studied sculpture as well, didn't you? In fact, some of your first awards were in sculpture.
Yeah, I wasn't planning to go to art school. Because I had been painting in my room and drawing in my room, and I thought, well, I don't need to go to art school for that. But I was always making things with my hands. And I think it was, do you remember that one-off TV show? I think it was called School of Saatchi, and they had Tracy Emin and a few people there sort of making withering remarks to these young artists. And I think it was Tracy Emin who said something about someone who said they were self-taught, and she said, no, you need to go to art school, it needs to be nurtured, you know, all of that. And I thought, well, oh, I guess Tracy Emin thinks you have to go to art school, well, I guess I should go to art school. But I thought, well, I should probably develop the sculpture a bit more. And when I developed the sculpture, it changed the painting that I was doing. They became a lot more sort of deep, with these deep shadows, and more sort of three-dimensional, as the two-dimensional work became more sculptural. And I found that all of the different disciplines all added on to each other.
I noticed that your sculptures are full of crocodiles, fish heads, or all with teeth, and similar to your paintings. Is there a hint of violence there as well as fun?
Yeah, there's a sort of visceral undertone to everything. There's a recurring theme of people being eaten alive, and I think it goes back to these sort of primordial fears. And these little characters that I have, they're sort of quite free of any hang-ups or boundaries, and they sort of go around in their little worlds doing whatever they want quite mindlessly, and I quite enjoy that.
You once said that you're fascinated by vice and worship decadence. Where do you think those feelings first started?
I think I wrote that when I was about 19, and I thought I wanted to be a sort of Lord Byron, Oscar Wilde kind of figure, you know, because I'd come out of this incredibly dull, grim industrial town, which is just very grey, and I wanted, you know, things to be sort of more beautiful and more interesting. But that's, I think, kind of subsided, that idea. The subject matter early on was sort of about that. I think that was kind of youthful exuberance.
I read that at that same age, 19, you travelled to post-communist countries, Serbia, Romania, Ukraine and Russia, where you encountered all manner of decadence. What sort of examples were that?
I mean, they weren't the most decadent places, but that started because Wizz Air had these really cheap flights out to these places. And I had a Polish boyfriend at the time when I was about 17, 18, and we went out one summer to Ukraine. This was before the Crimea was annexed, and we went all across Ukraine and down into the Crimea. And it was really extraordinary as a place, just really fascinating and quite grim in many ways, but sort of enthusiastic at the same time. The people in Ukraine were really amazing. I mean, whenever you went on a train, everyone would start sharing food with you, and they'd be singing, and you know, you would sit next to someone and they would have eggs from their garden and cucumbers, and there was an old man, well, older man, he was probably about 40, but he said, oh, I have a beautiful daughter who wants British passport. I put you on phone to her, and suddenly I approach this woman, say, who is this? You know, and we went and we just camped on a beach somewhere called Cocktobel, and just bought watermelons for sort of 20p, and just sort of bummed around. It was really, 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 really cheap, and there was this weird beachfront there with these babushkas selling these amazing cakes, and there was somebody sort of holding a crocodile you could have a photo with, and someone with a peacock, and someone would come along and they would just yank off some feathers from this peacock and sell them to people, and that was all quite strange. Yeah, and we went all around Romania and Serbia and those places, but later on we did a sort of gap year and we decided to go sort of overland, and we took the train from Ukraine to Moscow, and the train full of Ukrainians was lovely, you know, singing, food, all of that. And as soon as we were on the train in Russia, it was just this instant, you know, grim atmosphere. And And so that was 4 days across Russia of just not speaking to anyone and just sort of staring out the window at the endless steppe.
I suppose it gives you a certain perspective now that there's a war going on there.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to claim like a personal connection, but it was very emotional seeing these places that you had, you know, traveled. I mean, when the Crimea was first annexed, it was quite deeply horrifying. Obviously, the Crimea was more of a Russian-speaking place in the first place. So, but when the Ukrainian invasion happened, that was, you know, deeply horrifying to see that. Mm. But amazing what the strength and resilience that came out afterwards, which doesn't surprise me at all, because the people who I met were all very proud and quite forward-thinking.
Anyway, back home, you reverted more, I think, to painting and drawing. And I know you still do some sculpture, but were you sort of reverting back to type?
I still make things with my hands, but I think it's really hard to pull off a good sculpture. I think when sculpture works, it's really simple. And I did this sort of crocodile head, and it's this very simple silhouette, and it's almost like a cactus or something from a distance. And, you know, when it works, it really works. And I tried making these very complicated sort of Baroque looking things. But yeah, when an idea comes for a sculpture, it kind of comes out really quickly and immediately, but it's a lot rarer than with paintings and drawings. And the thing I do most is drawing. I'm always doing that, and I think that's where the emotion is. And then when an idea is suitable for either a painting or just as a drawing or as a sculpture, I think it's quite obvious on paper.
I thought it was interesting what you were saying there about your father being a landscape and architectural drawer. And I know that there's lots of landscapes and architecture in your paintings. I wondered if that was the influence of your father.
I'm not sure if there's a connection to him. I think his work is very different. But yeah, there's a lot of architects in the family, and I really love I mean, it's not what you asked, but I really love architectural. When I do drawings, they have these sort of architectural caprices, a bit like Piranesi. But the panoramas and things like that, I think they work very well as sort of settings for the scenes I'm trying to make. I mean, I'll look at everything, you know, whether it's the landscape out the window or in a painting or something. I'm quite magpie-like. And I quite like those medieval paintings where it's a sort of landscape going off into the background and there's lots of little things going on. I mean, the first thing I think it was you and I had this chat before. It was when I first saw Where's Wally, which was obviously inspired by sort of Hieronymus Bosch and people like that. But that was my favorite thing when I was a child. I mean, I've got it now. They're really amazing pieces of artwork, those Where's Wally books. He does so many different landscapes and settings, and all of the little figures sort of getting up to all sorts of things. I think it's amazing. And yeah, from life, I mean, I sketch as well. I've done a series of paintings recently that have paintings that have mountain from the Polish Tatra Mountains, where I went over the last couple of years, which were pretty incredible.
You like volcanoes, don't you?
Yeah, I love volcanoes. There's nothing more primordial than a volcano going off. We went on a couple of holidays where we ended up sort of stranded because the volcano went off. there was the Icelandic one. We were in Serbia and got stuck there. And then in Costa Rica, one went off and there was just sort of, you could feel it in the air. And then in Bali, I'm not that well traveled. I mean, I don't go away that often. So it seemed quite...
They followed you around.
They were following me. It sounds like I'm off every other week, but you know, this was like my special holiday of the year and we were stuck there. But it was fine really, because it meant a week more in Bali, so that was brilliant. But you could see this volcano going off on the horizon a few miles away, and the air was full of it. But it meant that I was late for a deadline, and I'd been painting this big landscape. And when I came back, I thought, oh, I'll add a volcano in as a sort of joke to sort of tease the gallery person with. And I really liked how it came out. So it became a bit of a motif after that. So a lot of these things start as jokes.
You said at the beginning that the world you depict is one of people living by instinct with a loose moral code. Do you think that if people are freed from their social constraint, a bit like Lord of the Flies, that people would revert to basic instincts and be violent towards each other?
No, I think people are quite cooperative, really. But I think when people are put in situations where their dignity is taken away and things like that, then people start to act strange. Where I was living was quite troubled, and there was a lot of very strange and not very happy people around, and I found that quite sort of interesting, because I mean I sound quite middle class, but my parents divorced just after I was born, so I grew up with my mother in this quite shabby bit of Swindon, as I said, surrounded by quite a lot of unpleasantness. But then I would go and visit my father's family, who would all be in quite nice houses and have quite good manners, and everything would be very pleasant. So there's this sort of strange dichotomy.
It's interesting, I think, that I think most people would be appalled by decadence, yet you find it both interesting and amusing.
I think I might have the wrong meaning in my mind of decadence, because actually when I look at the meaning of it, it means a sort of decay, doesn't it? Whereas I was sort of thinking of it as sort of Epicurean pleasure and beauty being a sort of, so I probably was using the wrong term with that. Also, I quite liked that sort of libertine sort of idea, sort of Victorian age, whenever it was, when there was this sort of grandeur of the sort of live fast, die young sort of people. There was this artist, Sebastian Horsley. I don't know if you knew of him. He was this, he wrote this amazing and very strange book called Dandy in the Underworld. And he went around Soho in a top hat and whatnot, and slept prostitutes. And he did a thing with Sarah Lucas where he was crucified in the Philippines, had himself nailed to a cross and all of that. I did all these really extreme things. I met him once just in the street. I wouldn't normally go up to someone, but he apparently liked it when people did. So I said, "Aren't you Sebastian Horsley?" And he said, "Do I owe you money?" But he was actually just the really, really polite, really sweet. You would expect this sort of whoremongering libertine to be really awful, but he was really nice.
There's a humour in your work, obviously. Do you think there's enough humour in art?
No. Or, I quite like the Dadaists and all of those people, and those medieval paintings are quite funny. The, you know, Hieronymus Bosch. And, yeah, I did a painting recently which had maybe a slightly too humorous element in it, and someone came up to me at the show and said that bit ruins the painting. It was like a really, I mean, it looks like something from a saucy seaside postcard, actually. So it's just, it was a mountain painting with a lake, and there's a man standing on a boat with a sort of comically big grin, throwing a woman over his shoulder with this sort of comedy penis. And that was the first part of the painting that I actually came up with. And I thought, well, that has to stay there. I think I always stand by the first thought with something. And I quite like that aspect of the painting, but I see what the person meant. You know, they wanted it to be a really serious, po-faced piece of work. And if that part wasn't in the painting, then I guess it would be a lot more thoughtful and in their minds, that being in it just sort of craps on the rest of it. But yeah, I knew it had to be there. And some works, it would be completely ruined if you started adding a load of inappropriate comedy. But it's part of the human experience, you know, the whole range of emotions. You know, we're not, you know, laughter and joy are very important as well. But I think every aspect of human emotion should be explored.
Do you ever have to censor yourself?
No, never. I sort of made a pact with myself that I wouldn't self-censor myself early on, because I think, yeah, that holds people back. And at art school, people, they hold themselves back quite a lot. And I think if you've got an idea, you should put it down and then even then think, how can I push this forward a little bit more? Because I think being subtle doesn't really get you anywhere. So I tried to be quite unsubtle and unfiltered, but as long as it's fitting with the work and appropriate, in my view, then it's fair game.
Let's look at your recurring motifs. You mentioned volcanoes, but another one is islands. A lot of your paintings have islands, so you often have sort of one or three trees growing out of them. What's your fascination with islands?
I mean, that's a recurring thing for people generally, the desert island and stories set on islands. And yeah, one of my, I've got it framed on my wall, a picture I did when I was six or something, and it's a map of Lundy Island. You know, it's in the Bristol Channel, it's sort of nature reserve. It's, and that's the first trip I remember taking with my family there and just being really amazed and fascinated by this exotic place. And I used to take myself to school when I was at junior school, and there was a sort of really incongruous pleasure garden in Swindon called Queen's Park, this kind of huge place that was actually quite nicely done. And it had this huge lake with all of these little islands on it. And when it was, you know, summer or something, you could actually walk onto a couple of them and they were just covered in bird crap. And I think I had that place in my mind because I hung out a lot there. I mean, it's quite boring to think of a, you know, you're looking at this exotic landscape in a painting. It's actually reminiscent of a crappy old park in Swindon. But yeah, and, you know, pirate novels and things like that when I was a child. There was a book by Mervyn Peake called Captain Slaughterboard, which completely fascinated me. And it was these pen and ink drawings and, you know, pirates and islands and all of these things. Yeah, I guess there's something, again, primordial about the island.
Yeah, and that goes too with the jungle animals that populate your paintings.
Yeah. Again, I think being quite a grey, quite dull place, you kind of long for the tropics and things like that, and palm trees and animals and stuff. Yeah, we had some National Geographic books in my school when I was, you know, infant school or whenever, and my earliest memories of that place is flicking through these National Geographic books, and I can see it really clearly in my mind, this gharial, you know, the long-snouted crocodile. And what is it, those huge flowers that smell of death? Those huge things. I remember all the images of those. If I saw that exact edition of the National Geographic in a charity shop or something, I would know that it was the exact one, but I've never been able to track it down.
And birds you like too. What is it about birds you like?
I mean, I haven't gone off them, but I painted loads of birds when I was younger. I really wanted a parrot when I was a child. And people said, oh, keeping a bird in a cage would be quite cruel, which it would be, but children are quite cruel. So that wouldn't have really concerned me. And apparently my father had had a parrot, an African grey parrot, when he was younger. So I was quite obsessed with the idea of this, but I've gone off that now. But yeah, they're sort of walking decorations. I quite liked that. And I just found them quite innately fascinating. And flamingos are quite ridiculous. I've got a stuffed one, which is one of my favourite possessions. And toucans, I genuinely thought that toucans were make-believe because I thought they couldn't possibly exist. So I'd see pictures of them and stuffed ones in a museum. But it wasn't until I saw one in real life, finally, that I was 100% sure that they were actually real.
Yeah, they're pretty amazing looking creatures.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about your process, James. For example, how do you start a work?
So I've got this practice of starting my day with left-handed sketches, and it's something that a lot of artists do, but I sort of stole the idea from Maggie Hambling's.
You're right-handed, presumably.
I'm right-handed, and so I find it very, very hard to sit down and just sketch or draw with my right hand, weirdly, because I feel like what I do draw has to be an actual art piece or something. So I sit down and I have a sketchbook and I work with my left hand and just sort of start moving it. And then all of these quite interesting things happen because there are no tricks up its sleeve. It just sort of does what it wants to do. And I've been doing that for the last couple of years, and it's some of the most interesting work I've ever done. It's sort of more linked to the subconscious or something, and the work I do is quite subconsciously driven. It also gets you into a sort of headspace where you can take some risks and things. It sort of breaks down a tendency to perfectionism, because you can make a drawing that's really rubbish and it's fine because it was your left hand, so it doesn't have to be good. And you can take some risks, and then you can take that into the actual artwork you're doing. And I find now I don't redo and redo things. I tend to be quite confident now with what I do the first time, and I think it's helped loosen up that part of my brain in some way. But yeah, you don't know what will happen, and so there's happy accidents. I think a lot of the best things that come out in art are these happy accidents. So that's been quite an advancement recently.
And do you use mainly oils and then start with the background, the landscape, and then fill in the figures, or is it the other way around?
I'll start by coming up with the idea whenever that comes along. So I'll be doing a lot of drawing and sketching and things. I mean, I didn't really used to plan things, and it used to completely screw me over not planning things. So now I do these oil sketches, and I quite enjoy doing them. They're quite nice little pieces in their own right, and it's quite nice to be able to just get things wrong there and work things out. And then I do the ground colors first, so the sky, and if it is a landscape, then I would do the sky and the ground and everything, and then I will put in the details of the landscape, you know, like volcano, trees, all of that, and it build up from the background forward. But sometimes it varies. If there's going to be like a big figure in the landscape, then I would probably revolve around that. But yeah, it depends.
People have said that the chalky fresco effect that you can see in your works is reminiscent of egg tempera. Is that what you're using?
I don't use egg tempera, but I know what you mean. I do lots of washes of colour, so I think that effect comes up from that. So I'll work in oils mostly. Sometimes I'll do a ground in some acrylic. Otherwise, I use quick drying oils, and then I use gouache and thin washes of gesso or things like that. And I'll do these washes of colour over it, so it creates this patina effect with some of the pieces. So, because if you look at a rock or bark on a tree or skin or anything, it's not just one color. You look into it and then you're drawn into all of the colors underneath, and it goes deeper and deeper. And I quite like creating that effect in a painting. It's not about making something lifelike or anything. I just like, you know, when you look at a really beautiful piece of wood and you see that grain and you look in and it sort of goes deeper and deeper. I love it if you get that effect. And it can be hard sometimes. You get a beautiful effect and then it's impossible to replicate afterwards, and it can be quite frustrating. But I'll throw oils and watercolor and just everything at it until it sort of builds up. They can look pretty precise and not very textural, you know, from a distance, but when you look up close, there's, you know, a lot of layers of paint and all of that in them.
Does it take you long to paint water?
It used to, and now I think I work in a slightly more free way. And yeah, before I used to use the paint very thickly and then try to create the depth afterwards. But now I've recently been doing it in a way where I'd put this kind of brown ground, you know, when you're in like the moors or something and the water is sort of the color of tea. So I'll do this sort of brown ground in some recent ones and then add on the blues and the blacks and the other brown colors with these sort of thin layers of oil paint. And then when that dries, because I use these quick drying oils that are, you know, dry within a day or two, and then I'll do washes of watercolor and gesso and like thin gesso. So you get that sort of very slight whiteness over it, like a kind of rime that you get on a cactus, if that makes sense. Mm. And that kind of creates these layers. But I realize I can get the effect of the light by having the negative space, by not filling that in. So,
and
this world of James Mortimer that you created with naked or semi-naked people cavorting about with gay abandon in a landscape, is that a theme that you will continue?
Well, I mean, I like to keep experimenting, and, you know, new subjects come. So I don't really know what I will paint next, because you never know what will happen. You know, some world event, or someone might die, or, you know, I might read a book I find interesting, or go somewhere I find interesting. So I'll just sort of carry on seeing where the mood takes me with things. But yeah, you have to keep experimenting, or it becomes sort of mannered and stale. So I don't like repeating myself. Sometimes, like with the volcanoes, I'll keep working with something while it feels important in my mind, and then eventually that something else comes along. But I also go back to things if it comes back into my mind. Like I didn't paint crocodiles for a few years, and then the way I painted changed quite a lot, and then I went back to them in a different way. So yeah, it's a continuous process.
Well, long may it continue, James, and thanks very much for talking today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
James Mortimer, showing how his works were born in childhood. Thank you for listening. Join me, Bob Chaundy, again to consider more art next week.